all the other ones that you see, there's a lot of them. The nodes, of course, the node is really, they need something to connect all these different modules together. And that's what we use. We have our own nodes. The Unity was first. In fact, the first two pieces that went up were Unity and Zarya. Ours was the American side. That was the Russian side. And then we built out from that. The Russians bought up Zesda. That was the living quarters of the, for, the, for them. We bought up Destiny. That was the main one for us. And then we just kept building out from there, you know, for the other countries. They were all building their own modules, but the space shuttle took them up. Let me drop it.
Yeah, one of the things I want to know, Paul, is that the Russian modules are connected together, but what I... are connected by together by what I'm going to call docking ports. Was there an agreement ahead of time that the design of the docking ports for the Russians and the Americans was a similar design? Do we have the option of docking a American module to a Russian module? Or must there be an adapter in between, like was required with the Soyuz, Apollo Soyuz, where because of two different docking mechanisms, somebody had to bring up an adapter that went between the two. WS2N, K2LIW, control.
Yeah, definitions are important when it comes to docking and berthing. Now, if you look at the space station now, there are... All right, so the Russians have four, and we have four. The Russians are... ...and dock. I'll use the word. You could have... location where you're going to have it. So you'll see crews.
Kevlar, series of Kevlar, and that type of thing. And they spoke with
that they're using. They won't get the answer. But based on original documents from NASA, NASA was going to build this thing back in the 1990s. And it was going to be called Transhab, and it was going to be much bigger than this. That beam, but it was going to be called Transhab, and they were going to attach it to one of the birthing modules, and people were going to live in there. And Transhab, since it's NASA, the information is available, and it's 1 foot thick when we drop it. So I'm taking a while, I guess, that, all these years, decades have gone by, and Bigelow claims he's got all kinds of modern stuff involved with this. I'm going to take a guess it's 8 inches, but I'm going to say it's not less than that. So that's my guess. I keep looking for that answer. Like I said last week, I know the outside diameter, and I would love to ask a question. I hope they'd say, a simple question: what's the inside diameter? So now, if I know the outside is, let's say, 10 feet, and they tell me the inside is 9 feet, I can just take the answer divided by 2, and I know the wall would be 6 inches, But they're keeping that a secret for some reason. I know if I was an astronaut, I would go into thinking, unless I knew how thick that was. One other comment I wanted to make on this landing of this rocket on the ADS. By the way, they have a name for the ship. Of course, I Still Love You is the name of the ship. And he calls it a ship now. He doesn't call it a barge because it no longer has rudders on it. They do have tow trucks, boats, tugboats pulling it in and out of tight locations, but it does have its own motors. And that's what keeps it steady in one location. But I was wondering how they were going to bring this thing back. I thought maybe they're going to have an auxiliary ship that pulls up 3 miles out. Nobody's on this barge when this thing lands, of course. And then the ship comes in, and people get off. And what they plan on doing, I saw an interview with Elon Musk. They have these big U-bolts, I'm going to call them U-bolts, pieces, I think somebody called them shoes. They go over the top of each leg, there's 4 legs, and they're going to weld them to the deck, it's a steel deck. So that's how they're going to get this thing so it doesn't fall over, all the way back to Cape Canaveral. They're worried about the winds, rough seas or something. They know they can get it back like that. Isn't that something? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, being a tower man from way back, I would have put guy wires on it from the spacecraft down to the corners of the barge, as opposed to welding it to the deck. But welding it is maybe cheaper and faster, as long as those legs are strong enough to hold that 150-foot-tall booster vertical. Guy wires would do a much better job, in my opinion. When I saw the beam module compacted, ready for flight, ready for shipment, it looks like an extremely thick cylinder. And from the cylindrical form to where it gets inflated and used on station, where it becomes approximately a spherical form, I'm having great trouble understanding how it's folded and how it to those individual circumferences of that cylinder, do they somehow slide past each other? Is it a bunch of telescoping tubes? I doubt it. But if I'm starting off, let me drop it. If I'm starting off with something that's an 8-inch thick wall, and I've got to somehow fold it up into a cylindrical shape and then inflate it into a spherical shape, I'm having a lot of trouble seeing how that works. I could do it with accordion pleating, but it's not accordion pleating. I could do it with sliding cylinders, but now you've got a whole bunch of joints if you do that. So when you see it uninflated, ready for shipment, versus the picture of what it looks like inflated, are you able to picture the steps that go in between those two separate modes of pull, WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out myself. I've seen many different videos and animation of what it's going to look like when it, you know, from the outside as it expands. It is full, I think it's 5x7 roughly. And, from the outside, it basically looks like this whole cylinder is just slowly turning into a sphere. Not quite a sphere, I think it's going to be 13x10. Now, you know, the one side has this common birthing mechanism. So that, you know, when you go through it, like any other location on most of the locations on the International Space Station, it's a rectangular door that you're going through. Even so, you know, around the rectangle is this circle, and the circle has these 16 bolts that bolt everything together. You know, what's inside that diameter of that circle is this 53-inch wide door, which is why, you know, you could bring big racks, batteries, of equipment, anything on the big side, which some of these racks is 4 foot by 4 foot that the space station has on board, and then you need this big area to bring stuff in and out, Metropolis. So that's why they have that, and then, you know, the Russians have the 39 inches diameter, you know, roughly a meter diameter. That's the disadvantage of having just a docking port for their rockets. You know, they can get people in and out and some equipment, but nothing big. We could do both on the American side. We have the berthing ports, which are 53 inches, in, you know, and then on a, you know, it looks like a big square door that opens up. And at the same time, we have docking ports, which are roughly about the same size diameter as the Russian side. So when we have people going up, it's pretty much just going to bring people and some supplies, and they're going to go through this 1 meter diameter location. To get back to Beam, you know, it looks to me on one animation, it looks like they have these four telescopic, I'm going to call them rods, extending from this square opening into Beam, helping push this thing out away from the space station. We drop it. Feeling it's a combination of that and air at the same time. The filling of this beam with air. Originally, Beam was going to send up tanks, and they did, with pressurized air, and it's not nitrogen, it's the same air that they breathe, it's nitrogen and oxygen, in these compressed tanks. And the original plan was for Beam to use their tanks to inflate this thing, and then the rest of it, toward the end, was going to be, they were going to use the air from the International Space Station. But now it's the other way around. They've decided to reverse this whole, you know, it sounds like recently from the interview. Originally, it's going to slowly inflate with the air from the International Space Station. And toward the end, to really pressurize it, they're going to use the tank sent up by Bigelow. There's going to be leftover air inside the tanks, probably. So they said that at the end, they'll just release that back to the station, and this way it's no loss to the station. I mean, every drop of air is counted. It's an amazing process from what I heard. Dick, over to you. This is WS2N.
At the place where the beam attaches to the International Space Station, is that just a simple door, or is that an airlock? And if, for instance, if beam developed a leak, I presume there's a way you can close a door which opens. International Space Station. As you close that door, the space station air pressure will push against that door and hold it closed. But is there an airlock in that area? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
No, there's no airlock, but every berthing location, I mean, you know, we have Destiny, we have Columbia, we have the Kuiper module, there's, you know, countless modules that are attached to the space station. Every location, including Beam, including Quest, where they go out for a spacewalk, every interconnecting part on the American side, Russia is a little bit different, but on the American side, we have these interfaces between every location, between every metal module. And the interface is two doors. Let's say we're talking about Destiny, the difference between Destiny and Harmony, one of the nodes that we have up there. For instance, you have two doors there, and they look like garage doors when they open them. And each door is on two sets of tracks. So it pulls away from the location inward. If you were on the inside, it would come toward you a little bit, and then it would ride up like a garage door. Then the opposite side has the exact same setup. So if somebody's on the other side, it would disconnect it and raise it up. And you're going to say, okay, well, suppose nobody's on the other side, like Bean, let me drive it. You know, all those doors, including Bean, you're going to be on the inside of the space station, you're going to be in the tranquility mode node, that's where it's located. And you're going to go over to the door after this thing is pressurized and inflated, the skull is inflated. You're going to open up the door, there's a crank, you crank it, and all these different dog type things, retract. It looks like about, at least a dozen of those. They retract, and then you pull the door toward you, and you raise it up above you on two tracks that the wheels ride on. And then you go, you look at the beams where that door is, and there's a crank, and they crank on that. Again, now you're looking at the outside of that door. You crank on it, and then you lift up the beam door. You push it in away from you, and then lift the door up like a garage door, and then you can enter the module. That's what I see on every one of these modules, interconnecting system that they have.
Now, a garage door, there's a certain kind of garage door where the door stays as one flat plane and it pivots on a hinge near the top. That's one kind of garage door. There's another kind of garage door where it's made by individual panels that slide up and over. It does a bend as it slides up. I didn't know that there was enough room for the door to do a pure slide up and get out of the way. Does it pivot on a hinge after the seal has been broken and you've done all the disconnect and now you want the door to move out of the way? Does it move by rotating or is it a pure slide? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, naturally, of course, it's one door. The door is 53 by 53, so it's one big square door. See, it's not like a garage door where you have different sections. But, it's a flat surface pushed against another flat surface, gasket in between, one face on the other face. So now when you pull it back, you have wheels near the top of the door, and you have wheels near the bottom. And you can imagine it's pulling back, following the tracks. The tracks are 90 degrees away from what you're looking at. So it comes back at you, and then they sharp. There's a sharp 90, and the wheels will follow that track all the way up, and then the top part of the track goes up, kind of like over your head. It'll follow that up, so it comes up on an angle, and that's how they do it. So, you know, if you're going through, let's say you walk on the floor, if you looked up, you would see this door on an angle hanging over your head. You know, I know there's no up and down, but you know what I mean. Back to you, Dick.
After the door has been loosened from its seal, does the top of the door pivot so that after the door has swung out of the way, it is now laying flat against the ceiling, so to speak? Does the whole flat door rotate 90 degrees around an upper hinge and then become flat against the ceiling? ODU Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, it's not flat against the ceiling. It's not 100% flat. From what I see, it's not a 45, but more than that, you know. So, and that's it. You know, if you watch them do an EVA, that's the best. You know, you watch the, there's always one or two astronauts getting these guys ready. And, you know, they're helping them suit up. And you can see when they close that door, you can see how it comes down. Looks like it's, you know, if you look at it quick, it looks like it's really right over your head, but you can tell it's on some kind of an angle. And they just pull it down, and, you know, and then they push it in, you know, it's following the track, but it slides down, the face is still not touching the other face, and then when they get down to the bottom, they follow the track in, and now the whole face touches at one time. This way, there's no sliding face against face. You know, they're not marring up the two faces. I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but there is no way that they're gonna, you know, ruin the gasket setup in between.
That gasket is extremely important. You don't want any scratches in it. You don't want any dirt in it. If somebody dropped a bolt and it fell into that gasket, a very small bolt, a 632 bolt, that could create an extremely nasty air leak and damage to the seal. What does that seal look like? My guess is they go through a very careful procedure of washing down that seal and oiling it up just before they close the door to make sure it's nice and clean. And is the seal on the non-movable part or on the movable door, or maybe both? W Paul, KQLAW, what does that seal look like?
I can't see it. I know. But I can't see it that close. You know, it's probably double seal, you know. I'm sure maybe even more. But you know, and then when they tighten these, you know, now the door is closed and you crank up. You know, they have a crank, and they crank it 40s. I call them dogs. You know, they expand. You know, they're tapered. They really force themselves against every different location. That's pretty good. So now, just wanted to say one other thing before we send the crew up there. They're gonna have to attach. You know, we have this pressure mating adapter, this black working thing. And you can see it's offset, like on a 22-degree offset. And that's another thing people always want to they want to know, why is it straight? You know, why does it look like a reducer that's straight on, and why does it have to have this offset? That was built for the space shuttle system. Gave them more room to do what they had to do anytime they wanted to unload a large module, for instance. But they're still up there. There's three of them. And that's the way we interface with the Russians. We have a berthing mechanism on one side, and on the opposite side we have an adapter that attaches to the Zarya, the first module of the Russian side. So that's one pressure mating adapter. And we have another one that's been used for many, many years for the space shuttle. That's still attached to the front end of the whole space station, forward facing. And then there's a third one, temporarily stored.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Temporarily attached to the port side of the Harmony module. That's eventually going to be disconnected very shortly. Relocated to the Zenith Point port of the Harmony module. And then that one and the other one that's already up there need adapters for the new crewed vehicles that are going to be going up there. And they're called EIDR, International Docking Adapter. And that'll be brought up on the next SpaceX mission. CRS number 9, that'll be coming up probably in June or July. And they'll attach that to the forward facing PMA-1. And that was the one that was lost. They were going to bring, they brought that up on CRS-7. That CRS-7 is the one that that blew up. So this is the third one that they built. And then later on, they'll bring up another one to attach to the other pressure mating adapter. And then they'll be all set to bring up two spacecraft with people in it from two different companies. One company being Boeing. They'll bring up their Starliner spacecraft. That'll be launched from Launch Complex 41 that they've taken over. And then you have the Dragon spacecraft, which will be also crewed, and that will be continue to launch from Launch Complex. That'll be launched from Launch Complex 39A, the old Apollo Launch Complex. That's what they're going to have people launch from. So it's exciting times. That'll probably happen toward the end of 2017. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I got a couple more crazy questions, Paul. Assuming there's one or two seals where these two modules come together, what I'd want to do is to set up a testing procedure where, as I'm starting to close the door, I first lightly close the door and apply a little bit of air between the two seals with a separate port of some kind to see that if it holds air pressure, if the seals are going to be doing their job. Before I bring the seals together real hard, I'd like to see that they're working correctly, because if somebody in the weightlessness of space, a chunk of junk could be floating around, a 632 screw, a nice long 632 screw, could decide to lodge itself across in the long dimension, across a seal. So when I bring the two doors, when I bring the door together to the seal lightly, and I try putting air pressure between them, the air would leak out real fast, and I'd go around with some kind of a listening device, find out where the leak is coming from, and then I'd find that 632 screw, as opposed to just bringing the seals together real hard, where now the presence of that 632 screw, in my example, would be damaging that seal if I brought them together real hard. I wonder if they do a step-by-step procedure like that, of gently nudging the seal, bringing the seal together to the door to see if it holds a small amount of air pressure before giving it a hard docking, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, because there's two doors on every interface, you have let's say you have a door on Cygnus, which we'll be leaving in a couple months, and then the door on Unity that it's attached to, that module. So before that leaves, they'll close the door to Cygnus, and crank it closed, and then they'll close the door to the space station, and then you got to remember this on it. You're looking at two doors, two square doors that are now closed. But around this whole thing, as you've been doing it, you're already sealed. You've got 16 bolts all attached. Then they do some kind of pressure test, I would imagine, between that small vestibule area. They know if that's all tight, and then they release all these bolts. four at a time, and very careful in how to unbolt these things. And then that's separated from the space station by the robotic arm, the counter arm too. But yeah, I'm sure, I think there's some kind of, I've heard that, they always check for pressure before doing something like that. And I want to get to, you asked about Juno, I should give you a piece of information on that as well, if you still want to know info on that. Going to Jupiter before it gets later. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, before Juno, I've got another crazy question, Paul. This last launch of, I'm going to call it 7,500 pounds of cargo, was a two-stage booster, and the first stage of that booster, 150 foot tall, came back home. Where did the second stage go? Where did the container for the 7,500 pounds of payload go? I am guessing the payload container is still attached. I don't know where the second stage is, and what's going to happen ultimately to the second stage booster and the container that brought the payload up. Are those eventually going to be stuffed with, is the payload container going to be stuffed with refuse and then deorbited and burn up? And I'm guessing that the second stage booster is still there, and that's what's going to create the thrust to do the deorbiting. Therefore, the second stage booster and the container filled up with refuse will eventually be deorbited and burn up. Is that approximately the principle of sometime in the future, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
I was talking about two different spacecraft. The spacecraft that's attached already, that's Cygnus, that came up with almost 8,000 pounds worth of stuff. They're still unloading that. But by the time that leaves in a couple of months, that's going to have tons of stuff attached to it. You know, all junk and everything. That's scheduled to burn up. That's just like a progress ship. That'll separate from the spacecraft and fire its thrusters. You know, it doesn't need much power to slow itself down, and eventually it goes into a deorbit and burns up over the Pacific Ocean. Unlike Dragon, they bring all the way back to the Pacific Ocean. They need, on a parachute, they need to bring scientific equipment back. In fact, all those blood tests and all the stuff that Scott Kelly was up there for a year and his partner, the Russian, they need to bring all that stuff back. It's all frozen. It's going to be put in a science box and put on board SpaceX to, along with thousands of other pounds of stuff, including a spacesuit they want to bring back. So, a couple of, maybe 3,000 pounds or so, maybe more, will be put on SpaceX to be brought back. So, the question is, where is all these boosters? All right, so it's a two-stage setup. First stage has 9 Merlin D engines, and the second one has 1. The first one, you know, is 156 feet high or something. That is now sitting on top of the ADA, the drone ship. The second stage pushed the Dragon into orbit, got it up to the final 17,500 miles an hour.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And then you can always review that, and you can see the Dragon and the trunk of the Dragon operating from the second stage. That in turn has its own thrusters, and that forces itself down, and that burns up and lands in the Atlantic Ocean. Or depending on the trajectory, sometimes they go out, depending on which inclination they're on. They actually have that plan to also land in the Indian Ocean. But in this case, went up to the northeast. So that deorbits and winds up in the ocean. The first stage, you know, interesting enough, when that's finished, it's already at, you know, 120 miles high or something. nitrogen rockets on it, and it turns itself around 180 degrees, and it's really flying horizontal to the ground. And then the three of these nine engines ignite and slow itself down, and then and actually start boosting itself back to toward land, or in this case toward the drone ship. And then it starts coming down tail first. Nitrogen jets help do that. Starts coming down tail first. Now it's still moving, way above the sound barrier, and they don't need to have the engines hit air and start to heat up, so they need to slow it down before it gets to that point. So they ignite the engines again, all three engines, of three of the nine engines, and it slows itself down, and eventually goes transonic. It gets to the point where it could fall through the atmosphere without overheating itself. And then that turn gets very close to where they want to be for the ship. Since they're flying through air, they have these four fins that open up. They look like big square tennis rackets. They open up, air is allowed to go through it, but they can articulate, and it helps bring it back to its location, flying actually using air to, almost like a wing effect to get it to the drone. And then the final engine, only now the center engine goes off. That's it's a nine-engine rocket, so just the center one goes off, slowing it down even more. Coming very close to landing on the drone, and just see the thing flying out of the sky. It was really cool. They had a helicopter or something flying and taking pictures of this thing coming out of the sky. And with the engine flaring, and the thing floated down to like, I think they said 4.5 miles an hour before it hit the deck. But it had to be 1 second, maybe 1.5 seconds before it hit the deck, and then you could see the four legs open up right at that last 2 seconds. Four legs popped open on this thing. From one end to the other end, they're 60 feet long, so pretty long legs. And they look like they're reinforced. I mean, the one that landed down the Pacific Ocean that time, the one leg broke and it fell over. I can see close up view that it looks like they reinforced these legs. I really was impressed how this thing landed. It only landed a couple of meters off the center of the drone ship, and that's the location of that thing. The fairings should be eventually coming back right now. They're losing them into the ocean, but they want to save them as well. Back to you, Dick.
So the real deorbit burn that slows it down from supersonic speeds, and then these tennis racket paddles that come out of the side make it fly a little bit like an airplane. At no time does it deploy a parachute. I'm a little bit amazed it doesn't slow down its forward velocity at some high altitude and do an awful lot of the drop by parachute, which would be very efficient. But then, of course, you've got to make sure you disconnect the parachute at the right time, that you turn on that one center Merlin engine, and I presume it is gimbaled, and that's the one that actually lands on the barge. Is that approximately true, Paul? Over to you, K2LAW.
An interview a long time ago, I remember he was interviewed, and he said that he experimented with parachutes, thinking about it, and, it never went to flight, but complicated and adds a lot of weight. Everything is weight. He didn't want anything to do with weight. I mean, that's why they go through this densification of the fluids now, of the RP-1, the rocket propellant one, and also the oxygen, the liquid oxygen. They bring that down to almost its freezing point. So, but that extra densification gives them, I think, an extra 20% or something more fuel. I forget the number. But every drop helps and gives them more of a margin to make these kinds of landings.
I'm guessing the fuel for the engines is hydrogen and oxygen. little bit amazed that they're not carried in liquid form like they are on the space shuttle booster. You make it sound like they brought it down not to the freezing temperature. Or maybe what you mean by freezing is that it is in liquid form, but they're a little bit above the temperature at which it would be a solid. So what is the fuel, and is the fuel kept in liquid form until it's used up all? WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, anytime they use the word RP1, they're talking about a refined kerosene. So that's what it is. It's a refined kerosene. They actually bring that down to a lower temperature. Normal, whatever temperature it used to be, it's about 50 degrees lower. And the same for liquid oxygen. They bring that down 50 degrees lower than it used to. Than the normal cryogenic liquid oxygen temperature that they use. Get the numbers offhand, but both are roughly 50 degrees cooler than they used to be a couple of months ago. So they had some problems with it the last couple of flights. They had a couple of aborts that went, you know, they had to wait a day or two to work out some of the fueling problems. So that's what it is. Yeah, you're right. The space shuttle used to be hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The only ones that do that now are the Delta IV rockets. They're liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. I think the Japanese H2A and H2B rockets, they're liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. A lot of them fly the RP-1, for instance, Cygnus, when that goes up, last two flights anyway, went up with the Atlas V rocket, built by, the United Launch Alliance, ULA, that's a combination of Lockheed and Boeing, and that Atlas V rocket, we dropped it. The Atlas V rocket is RP-1, that's a refined kerosene as well, liquid oxygen. And when Orbital ATK launches their Cygnus, their next Cygnus spacecraft, they finish their contract with Atlas. Although they could do it in the future if they needed to, they'll be launching from Wallops Island, Virginia again. They rebuilt that place after the last catastrophe that they had there, and that'll be, launching RP-1 as well, liquid oxygen. And the only difference really with, they're going to be launching, they built their own rocket called Antares, and that flew a couple of times, but that was the one that blew up, and they were using the Russian NK-33 engines that were rebuilt by Aerojet. And now they're going to be built, they completely different engines, but again, they're Russian engines, and they're called RD-181, and that'll fly for the first time, I don't know, about probably 4 or 5 months from now. Back to you, Dick.
Question for Bill. Yeah, I got a question first, but go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, you got it, John.
Yeah, Jim, VE3JIW in Canada. He's asking about the space probe in emergency mode. Does Paul know anything about this? Is there a space probe that they're having troubles with? I didn't hear Paul mention that.
Do I have it, Dick? I think I have it. Let me see if I have it. This is WS2N. Strange ID on that. Dick, am I making it through?
You sound beautiful, Paul. Please proceed.
Okay, the ID sounds a little soft. Eric made it a little soft. That's okay. Yeah, I know what John's talking about. And I got a list here a mile long, and Dick added to it with Juno. But one of the things on the list was just what you're talking about. Kepler is in what they call the emergency mode. This thing is in orbit around the sun. It's behind the Earth. I think it's some 70 million miles away, so it's, I don't know, five to 8 minutes or maybe more communication distance at the speed of light. in its K, they call it the K2, that means Kepler 2, Kepler, we've talked about many times on the net, had failing reaction wheels, and it has four on board, two failed, so if another one failed, they think that could be it, and what I read is that could be what happened. The other one might have failed, so could be the end of the Kepler 2, if they can't recover this. They have trouble keeping it located in a proper position. It was looking behind them, and they wanted to turn around 180 degrees, but before they could do that, they got a signal from Kepler saying it's not working out, and it's what they call emergency mode. So right now they're working through it, and they're going to see if they can bring it back. I just think they need to build a new Kepler and send it up, John.
Sounds like you're right, Paul. Isn't that something? Wheels up there are giving them trouble, and wheels on Mars. I think we should get rid of wheels. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I wish Kepler had been designed from the beginning to use these little wings on the side that hit the solar wind as a method of orienting, as opposed to inertial wheels. The good news about inertial wheels, which are used on Hubble and Kepler, is that you can move the spacecraft quite fast. The bad news is that when they grind up their bearings, they give you a lot of grief. So had they made the design so that it does slow steering by way of paddles picking up solar wind, which is the K2 mode that they went into, and it wasn't designed to do that, I don't think. I think that would have been a superior design. Back to you for comments on that, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they never planned on it. You know, they just thought they were going to use the reaction wheels. It doesn't have solar panels sticking out, you know, like if you look at the Dragon, you know, the Dragon has these four panels on each side sticking out, you know, and that would be the way to go. It does have solar panels, but if you take a bottle and surround it, let's say, with four straight sides, how would I describe that? That's what Kepler looks like. Instead of putting solar cells, you know, around a cylindrical body like you did with Pathfinder when they sent that to the moon, or that type of design, they made flat panels and they just put them up against this cylindrical object called Kepler. So there's no wings sticking out, you know, what I like to call solar panel wings. So you have these flat surfaces, and naturally you have an edge, you know, every now and then, probably at it would be at a 90-degree angle to one another. And if you could take that and balance it against the solar wind, they have a point, you know, the edge of the, where they have made it together, facing the sun, and keeping it at a balance point, that's how they're keeping it steady. But they do need the help of these reaction wheels. I don't know. I mean, the one report said that it's a possibility that one of those failed. And if it did, that's the end of mission. Dick, over to you.
So there was a total of four reaction wheels on board. I guess one was a spare, but they lost two, which means of the two that are left, you can control two of the axes, but not the third. But maybe the third axis was being controlled by the external paddle picking up solar wind. If one more reaction wheel or two more reaction wheels fails, I guess you're saying they're out of control in order to force the orientation of the spacecraft. Is that our best guess as to what's going on, Paul? Over to you, K2RAW.
That's the way I interpret it. I'm reading that on two different websites now. This only came out within the last 24 hours, so this is all new. There you go. I know you wanted to know about Geonosic, so I'll give you quick information on that in case anybody else has any questions. That took off in 2011, like you said, in August, and I would launch on an Atlas V rocket, the same kind of rocket that just launched Cygnus up a couple of weeks ago. The difference is it was an Atlas 551, so the numbers mean something. 551 in this case would mean the 5 foot diameter, but not 5 foot, 5 meter, 5 meter diameter fairing. So you can put a very wide thing in that location on top of the Atlas V rocket. The second five means five booster rockets attached to it, surrounded with five booster rockets. You could run two of them, then it would be a 5-2-1. And then the last one, so you got 5-5-1. The last one means for the second stage. The second stage has one rocket in it. In this case, it's the Reliable Centaur rocket, which has been used for decades. They do have plans of eventually having two rockets on board on different configurations of rockets. But as of today, none of them have run two. So Juno took off, and it's actually only gone around the Earth, if you want to consider around orbit, around Earth, or around the Sun anyway, around the Sun twice. Let me drop it. Not around the Earth, but around the Sun twice. Even so, it's taken 6 years to get to Jupiter. It launched from Earth and then went all the way around the Sun and then came back to Earth a couple of years later. Actually, it was in October 9th, 2013. I remember that because I have a card from JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. At the time, they were looking for amateur radio operators to transmit extremely slow CW. And we were all going to do it collectively on Earth and just transmit in coordination with what they sent on a computer at the exact timing. And if you did that and sent it in and let them know that you participated, you eventually, many, many months later, you got a card back, beautiful card from Jet Propulsion Laboratory recognizing that we did that. We dropped it. So that was my contribution to Juno. Outside of talking about it, then as the years went by, by the way, when it passed Earth, the reason for passing Earth is gravity assist. You needed to accelerate the spacecraft. Of course, we've been doing that for decades with spacecraft to get them up to a higher speed to get out to different locations in the solar system. And when it passed Earth in October of 2013, it gained a little over 8,000 miles per hour, faster than what it was going. And that is enough to get it to its present location. So it's really 1.5 times around the Sun. But it's taken 6 years to get there, and it's almost there. It's getting close to Jupiter now. It'll be going into a polar orbit as opposed to an equatorial orbit similar to what Galileo was in. Galileo spent 5 years out of Jupiter's orbit investigating all the moons. This thing is going to go into a polar orbit. Originally, it was planned for 33 orbits, and now they've extended it to 37 orbits, and it's going to be elongated, quite an elliptical type of orbit, and it's going to take a couple of years to do that, and after all those orbits, they plan on decommissioning it.